The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of Unsigned Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin. This podcast is part of a series where we talk to writers about the craft and process of writing and what makes them tick. Thank you for taking the time to listen and we hope you enjoy this episode.
This time we speak to Neil Griffiths. Neil's the author of Betrayal in Naples and Saving Caravaggio, as well as the more recent As a God Might Be, published by Dodo Inc. He's also the founder of the Republic of Consciousness Prize.
In this episode, we talk about, amongst other things, today's fictional ecosystem and the future of the experimental novel, whether or not Neil's latest novel is to be his last, and the current golden age of indie publishing. We started by asking Neil what led to him establishing a literary prize.
Well, I mean, weirdly, this is my thesis. 2007 financial crash had a real impact on the large publishing houses. They essentially had to cull their mid-list and their loss-leading literary fiction. They couldn't, essentially, the margins were too slim on books. They couldn't survive. And that allowed small presses to kind of move in, because they could not only just gather up the kind of the literary, you know, the sort of loss leading literary novelists, but also some of the mid-list that, you know, that were no longer, I mean, people like Matt Thorne, Toby Litt, all of those people who were being published by, you know, Hamish Hamilton or whatever, were no longer being published by, you know, Penguin Random House or whatever. That allowed, I think, to a certain degree, the opportunity for the small presses. But actually what the small presses were interested in was more formally interesting and experimental work. But on the other hand, they could still pick up novelists and publish them, and therefore they didn't have the same kind of overheads and could take those kind of risks. So two things happened at the same time. But I put it all, I think without that crash, I think in the end that crash was a good thing for publishing, because it created a space for small presses to do that, to pick up the slack, and that gave them a certain amount of stability to do the things they wanted to do.
And do you think there's a sort of fundamental difference in what smaller indie presses are looking to publish? Is there something that, suppose there wasn't the crash in 2007, what would the landscape look like now? Which books wouldn't have been published, do you think?
Well, I think that's a good question, because there's always, Faber always playing around the edges of difficult fiction, Granter to a certain degree. I mean, I think they are playing reasonably safe with difficult, as it were. But I would definitely say there is Zone, which is Fitzcarraldo Edition's sort of first big success, is a Zone by Matthias Ennar, which is one of my favourite books of all time, I don't think would have been published in this country, because I don't think enough translated fiction is being published. And, you know, it was a big, you know, French novel, all in one sentence, 550 pages long, you know, formally difficult, very serious content. I don't think that would have been published. Girl is a half-formed thing, you know, the cultural phenomenon, didn't find a publisher for a long, long time until Gabby Begger found it. So, those two things. Equally, I don't think my new novel would never have found a publisher. It barely found a publisher, you know, now, even amongst the small presses, because the subject matter's not necessarily conducive to the English literary sensibility. But I think there are a number of ones. Joanna Walsh may not have found as much success without that microclimate for it. So I think lots of stuff.
I guess maybe we could sort of talk a little bit about the prize, the Republic of Consciousness price. Yeah. And that feels very much aligned with that sort of shift towards maybe more difficult, harder sort of literary fiction. Can you maybe describe a little bit about how that came about and what you're sort of seeking through that?
Well, it was fairly straightforward in the sense that I wrote this long novel over 9 years and lost my agent, and I went to see my ex-editor from Penguin, who bought my first two novels, who's now working for Verso, and sort of said, what am I going to do? You know, I've written a novel, my agent won't even, you know. And he said, why don't you look at, you know, Gally Beggar or Fitzcarraldo editions? And I'd never heard of them. So I went home, Googled them, as you do, and suddenly realised that there was this entire world out there that I hadn't even really noticed. So I just immediately subscribed to two or three of these small presses, suddenly realised that actually it was like a coming home for me. I suddenly realised actually where I belonged. But what I also realised quite quickly is, and the reason, you know, they have a subscription model, you know, and you know, some of them have kind of donate buttons on their website, is that they are often publishing quite difficult works, and are financially quite vulnerable to I mean, they need a certain amount of success in order to be financially viable, but they still persist. And so I have a certain amount of disposable income, as I did then, I donated a few hundred quid to Gally Beggar, because they had a donate button, and I read, you know, Girls Half All Thing and Alex Phoebe's Playthings, which is a brilliant novel. And I suddenly realised, well, that's just a kind of drop in the ocean, and therefore, what other way could one support these presses by, other than giving the odd, you know, donation? And that made me realise. And then I realised that about 10 years before, not 10 years, sort of 8 years before, I got shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award with my second novel, and realised that tiny bit of exposure made a real difference. And so I just suddenly thought, well, maybe if we just start a prize for small presses, I can raise some money, put in some of my own cash as a kind of minor philanthropic gesture, then raise some money, raise some profile. And actually what's going to happen is it's not going to have a huge impact, but a little bit of money goes a long way with small presses, plus any media is going to have an impact on, you know, sales to a small degree. But actually we're talking about quite small increments. And I don't know whether you know this, the only time I've trended on Twitter is when I gave out the statistics for the average sale of literary fiction in this country, and it's 264 copies.
Quite grim.
That's quite
grim statistics.
Yeah. So if you think we got into the trade press. We also got on to BBC Radio London, and then the Guardian did the long list, the short list, and the winner. If that sold a few copies, and then those few copies sold a more few copies because of plus, you know, the small amount of money, and the fact that people can start kind of using this as a you know, tiny marketing tool, all of those things make a small amount of difference, and, you know, hopefully cumulatively, and as we go on year after year, it makes a difference. So, you know, two or three times now, maybe our winner becomes a kind of breakout book because we've just about got enough media coverage for that to happen.
And in terms of the sort of direction or the books that you're considering, I mean, obviously indie publishing now, since The Crash, it's spread to become quite a large array of different books, but it seems quite focused in a way, also nebulous in another way, what the
we have two criteria. One is the publisher has to be fewer than 5 full-time paid workers. Essentially, that distinguishes between you know, the cottage industry that is small presses and independents like Canongate or whatever. So that establishes the size of a publisher. And then I essentially nicked a line from the Gallibega website, which is, they said they were interested in hardcore literary fiction and gorgeous prose. So,
great line.
Yeah, so I lifted that and said that's our criteria. Because we still do get sent, I have to say, quite bland genre novels or quite bland semi-autobiographical kind of workplace novels. No, we're interested in hardcore literary fiction and gorgeous prose. So, you know, our long list and short list and winner very much reflects that. Mm. And so it's supporting the kind of fiction that we were talking about, you know, a second ago. Mm.
And maybe let's backtrack a bit then to talk about your own writing, because it seems like your first novels were quite crime fiction genre sort of.
Well, they I mean, that's how Penguin chose to position them. But actually, if you read the Amazon reviews of my second novel, you'll see that anybody who likes crime was bored silly by my novel. They're literary they're kind of literary fiction with crime as a kind of pivot. Mm. And they're set in Naples or southern Italy, and they but actually their character and sort of psychologically driven, and therefore, you know, they're quite slow in terms of genre. They don't require, you know, plot or twist to drive the narrative. So yes, that they're not, in a sense, thematically they are novels with a that have an ethical question at the centre of them, of the major characters. Yeah. But at the same time, my new novel is kind of different in kind.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I was getting at. Yeah. You seem to have sort of followed a trajectory where your new novel, As a God Might Be, is very much, I would say, in that area of hardcore literary fiction with gorgeous prose, which it feels like you've followed some sort of path from those early novels to the latest. And I guess I was wondering sort of where you started writing, first of all, and what sort of path has led.
Well, if I talk about where I started, As a God Might Be is I called it in my little talk at the launch, is it's kind of a homecoming, because I wanted to write in my kind of mid-teens when I started reading the novels of Dostoevsky. And it's kind of taken me 40-odd years to arrive at a novel that is not unlike Dostoevsky, both in scope and in content, and it wears its influences fairly clearly, in the sense that it talks quite a lot about Dostoevsky in the novel itself. Weirdly, the two novels I got published by Penguin, as proud of them as I kind of am, they were a bit of a mistake. I hadn't planned. What happened was I wanted to write, you know, quite serious, kind of philosophically, ethically driven narratives from an early age. I was not getting a great deal of success in my 20s. I left the country, moved to Paris for a couple of years, then came back, still no success, moved to New York for a couple of years, realised I wasn't doing any writing there whatsoever, and came back. Then wrote something which is very much kind of literary fiction, a very kind of internalised piece of fiction. Got a good agent, but she couldn't sell it. So then I'm like 30, 31, 32, can't remember. So things aren't going particularly well as a writer. So I've probably at this point written four novels, none of which have, you know, one's got an agent and then she hasn't sold it. So Then I write another one, and she says she can't sell it. So then I'm now agentless again. So it's pretty miserable. And I'm then thinking, what am I going to do? What kind of novel am I going to write? And I, because I realise, you know, in, you know, deeply internal narratives about the, you know, the psychological world of a 30-something male living in London is clearly not doing it. However good it is, clearly it's not interesting enough. And then I got a phone call from a friend, and he said he lived in, he moved to Naples for the 1990 Italian World Cup. He had a vision. He moved there when he was about 35. He had a vision to spend the rest of his life moving from World Cup city to World Cup city.
Oh, he made that.
What?
He made that decision before FIFA started their current decision-making process.
But he actually never left Naples. So he didn't even go to, you know, to the 1994 or 90, you know, he basically went. That was his idea. And he never left Naples. He was teaching English there. He said, one of my students is coming over. He wants conversation classes. Can you meet him for a couple of hours each morning to do conversation classes? I didn't have a job. I was writing. You know, I had nothing better to do. So I met him in a hotel near Bloomsbury. And I was like, you know, 30, mid-30s, and he was a man in his late 50s. I asked him what he did. He said, I'm the president of the Court of Murder in Naples.
It's quite a title.
Yeah. And you'd think the light bulb in a way would have gone on immediately, but it didn't. But he basically did invite me to go to Naples to see a Camorra trial. And then I was away somewhere, and I said to my partner, actually, you know, maybe I'll go to Naples, go and watch a Camorra trial and write something about that. You know, just kind of not even think about, you know, the kind of highly literary internal narrative that I have been doing. Try and do something completely different. So I did, and so I went to Naples for a few days, just sat in on a Camorra trial. I mean, I wrote about the Camorra before Robert Saviano did. Four or five years, they just didn't read any of it because it was all published in English. But that was in a pretty, I mean, Naples is a pretty intense place. It was there. The trial was very intense. There was like 15 people in a cage, Camorra members on trial for, you know, 3 car bombs. There was a pentito, a guy who turned state's witness on a TV screen. And when I turned up, Massimo, the judge, met me outside the court. Big new court built for the big trials of the 80s and 90s. And he met me outside, where all of the family of the defendants were lining up to go in. And the judge met me in front of them outside. So where do I want to sit? Do I want to sit with the journalists? Or do I want to sit with the families of the accused? And he said, for you, I think it'd be interesting to sit with the families, and basically led me up into this this huge courtroom with kind of tiered seating and bulletproof glass at the bottom, dividing us from the courtroom. The journalists were kind of in the stalls, as it were, and so I had to sit, obviously listening to something in Italian, which I, you know, can barely understand a word, but in a sense, you don't really have to understand what's going on. You understand what's going on because of the sort of innate drama and kind of physical language.
Well, the atmosphere is palpable.
Yeah, and but more palpable was you know, there was probably about 50 seats, but there was only about 20 of us. But they were all the girlfriends and wives of these young men in the cage, and they were all looking at me, thinking, wasn't he just with the judge? And that was, in a sense, that was the... Also, when I arrived in Naples, I'd come down with some kind of mild flu. So I was in a slightly weird mental state. So I was sort of in a heightened state of kind of awareness, sitting in a room with, you know, the wives and whatever, all kind of looking at me. And in a sense, my novel was based on that moment, a kind of sense of kind of paranoia and being put in that position. And
was that writing process different then? Did you feel, when you sort of left that courtroom on the first day, okay, I've got something here, I write it down, and as you wrote it, were you...
I tend to, the writing process generally for me doesn't really include huge amounts of research, in the sense I think fiction is an act of the imagination, and, you know, research intrudes too much. So I tend to think, as a writer, go through, have the experience, and you will filter what is required when you go back to the page. I think that is true. It is much more difficult to come back to London and then suddenly write a novel, because you feel you've really engaged with everything. But when you're in London, you suddenly can't remember what anything looked like. And you suddenly realise that, you know, novel writing is often about detail and noticing. And then you kind of think, I went back and forth for the first novel, and I kept going back for the second novel. But it's harder work, I think. It really is harder work than writing something that you're just culturally closer to. On the other hand, I think that also creates a kind of otherness and a kind of tension in the prose. My new novel I've used much more of my real life, and that makes it much easier. I mean, when they say write what you know, it might be only write what you know because it's much easier. If you write what you don't know, it's much harder.
But I wonder if, for things like writing about Naples, if you're from the point of view of an outsider, whether the description that you might bring in would be more, you know, making the familiar unfamiliar something, because you've got that perspective.
Yeah.
I wonder if someone who is Neapolitan had written the same thing, it would be so obvious, little things that you've put in, they would just skip over it. So maybe for a reader, it sort of adds...
Yeah, I mean, I think
it was exoticism, I guess.
Yes, I mean, and certainly I got letters saying I'd made some two or three horrendous mistakes. Neapolitans would never do that. So I think, you know, in a sense, Neapolitans would get everything right. But I'm looking, and my character arrives in Naples rather like it, never been there, is in a state of delirium and whatever. So all that is the filter by which he sees what is a... And in the height of summer, and Naples in the height of summer is 40 degrees, lots of the buildings are made of tufo, which is a black porous rock from Vesuvius. And you've got Vesuvius just over the, and you've got, I mean, it's a fucked up place. And when I went there, there were no kind of multinational brands. I mean, I think McDonald's has snuck in, and I think maybe Starbucks has snuck in over the last 15 years or 10 years, whatever. But back then, it was, and no tourists, because everyone thought it was too dangerous. They all gone to Sorrento or Capri or whatever. So it's a really kind of febrile atmosphere. And as an outsider, that's what you want to, play back.
And how do you go about capturing that in a sort of more practical sense? And I guess leading on from that, your writing style or routine in general. I mean, when you took return trips to Naples, were you sort of spending a few hours walking around and going back to the hotel room and furiously scribbling?
No, not at all. My process is... I always start from the beginning, I don't plan. So I essentially start with a first sentence, And if I haven't got the right first sentence, I can't start at all. I can't start, you know, in the middle and work outwards. I can't start vaguely, you know, whatever. I have to have a first sentence.
And does it, so for in the example, if you're going to the courtroom, you come out thinking there's something here. This could turn into a piece of fiction. How do you know where the start is going to be?
I think it just, I mean, it come it for me. It absolutely. I'm walking around somewhere else, and this has happened in my three published novels. The first line appears to me.
And that could be a few days later.
Yeah,
I'm going to write this book now. Where has it started?
No, the whole
thing comes together.
Yeah.
This is the book, and this is where it starts.
And so you come, you have the first sentence, and then you start writing. So what I do is, and this is the case of the last three novels, is with the first sentence I can start, and then I basically keep writing, depending on work, family, whatever. I keep writing until I stop. So that might be, you know, two or three pages. Then the next time I go back, I start at the beginning, and I essentially revise till I've got six pages, and then I start at the beginning and revise until I've got 12 pages, and I start at the beginning because that's for me the most difficult part. Because at this point, I think, I described it the other day as writing a novel. I feel like is like building a pier out into the sea, not a bridge, because I don't think it gets anywhere. Actually, I think it stops at certain point, but is not ever finished. It's like building out a pier, but you're actually building the pier out into the sea without the supports. That's what it feels like to me. So, and I think it's around 30,000 words before I feel the thing actually has the kind of supports underneath it, it has the structural integrity that I can then carry on. I'm building that structural integrity by keep going back into the beginning and just getting it right. So,
and is that a process of editing? So you've written, say, three pages of the first. Yeah. When you come back, do you leave that file or leave those pages?
No.
Don't look at them and just literally start from scratch.
I open up the same document and I'll have the first line and I will finesse the first paragraph.
So sort of editing that, editing the
rewriting,
previous days, you start once.
Yeah, and then I go back and I go back and I back. So and after a while. And this may, but maybe, you know, because I have to write over quite a long time. You know, now those books were slightly different. I could write them quicker because I didn't have such a stressful job and I didn't have a young family. But after a while, maybe 30 pages in or whatever, I might feel as though I don't have to go back to the beginning. Mm. I might start, you know, at the beginning of chapter two or chapter three because I think I've basically got. But what I'm trying to do is I am trying to get to the end. So the process for me is getting from the beginning to the end. Once I've got to the end, then I have a sense of all the internal structure, how it all, and it means that when I then go back to the beginning again, I have a better sense of the kind of internal world of the book. Because I've always believed once you're at the end of a book, it's only almost literally you put the final full stop, is the thing falls into place. And you kind of go, yeah, that, you know, that works and that doesn't work. But you kind of don't know that until the thing is there in front of you and you can kind of maybe look at it. Yeah, I mean, because I always feel the whole book's in my head anyway.
But you don't plan so much.
No planning.
But you
at
just
all.
That's a sense of just confidence that it will, a sort of plot will fall out of it, or the themes are all there. You're sort of happy before you start writing.
But
you discover it as you're going.
Yeah, I mean, I've I've always been able to finish novels.
Yeah, for example, do you have many drafts where you've got to 15 pages and you never really opened it up again?
No. There's only one novel. When I was shortlisted for the Costner, and I thought, here's an opportunity for my next novel to be exactly the novel I want to write, I had this idea for a novel set in Buenos Aires. So I took my family to Buenos Aires for 6 weeks. I had what I thought and still think is a great idea, but I came back and I got 80,000 words in, and it was just awful. It was just awful on every level. The prose was terrible. I couldn't work out what the story was. There was no redeeming factors to it, and so I abandoned it. That's the only time.
Do you think that there's any link between writing in a sort of foreign environment? I don't know if you have a routine or you have a place that you write. Do you feel that's an important aspect, or it doesn't make any difference? You could write it anywhere.
I didn't write until I got back from Buenos Aires. I actually think that the subject matter and the city were just too big for my brain. Naples is tiny. It's a million people and whatever. I know you've been to Buenos Aires.
I've lived there for a while.
It's just completely insane, isn't it? I just don't think I couldn't encompass it in my head, and therefore actually had a 30-year span, or it was set in present day, but actually it kind of had the residue of the dirty war or whatever. Trying to take a kind of 30-year thing, the size of the city and the characters didn't have the capacity.
Do you think that's one to come back to sort of later on, but later in your sort of development?
I don't know. I mean, I keep telling people that I'm with as a god might be that I'm done. I'm written out. And to a certain degree, I think that's right. There are things that I want to write, but they're going to be smaller pieces of work. I mean, you know, as a god might be, 600 pages, 200,000 words. It's taken me 9 years. So I don't think I'm ever going to do. Yeah, I'll take that huge Buenos Aires novel and just turn it into a short story or something. But I don't feel I'm going to write a big novel again.
What led to that? Just the weight of the process of writing for 9 years, or you just feel that you've answered the thing you wanted to answer?
I think to write a novel of that size, legitimately, you have to want to write that subject matter, and that story has to be everything, you know, has to be everything to you, and it was and it is. Whereas the Buenos Aires novel is a really interesting idea. I almost don't feel that I have the I would have the emotional commitment that you actually have to write a big novel again.
I think there's a bit of insincerity to. I don't want to sort of bring up any names or accuse anyone of this, but I think that there's a sense of value for money with books that, especially the bigger publishers, are willing to maybe support longer novels that don't have that sort of integral idea.
No, you're right. Yeah, yeah.
So it's interesting that you say.
I mean, I was talking to someone the other day saying that, you know, I'm not sure. I don't really trust novelists that write too many novels, because they're really hard to write, and who has millions of ideas? I mean, you know, the idea as a novelist as a career seems to me slightly wrong or dissonant. And I think you're absolutely right. I think big novels, they need to earn their place, and there should be fewer of them. And I think as a writer, I mean, my first two novels are about 110,000 words, which feels about kind of right for the length of a novel. And I remember, you know, sending it to a kind of agent friend of mine, who decided my work needed editing based on the fact how long it was before she'd even read it. And because I'm reasonably good at self-editing, reasonably critical, I really had to convince myself I'd earned, or the book had earned its 200,000 pages. And I think that's a really important question for a novelist to ask themselves. Unless you're preternaturally good at structure, and therefore you can really hold your reader for the show. And some people do like to be very engrossed in long novels. I think you're right. I think they have to earn themselves. And I can't imagine many novelists do have many 200,000 word novels in there.
I saw the time approaching when I would be left alone of the party of Unsound Method.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Hope you're enjoying it. Do follow us at unsoundmethods.co.uk or on Twitter at unsoundmethods.
Going back to the new novel then, so can you maybe describe a bit of the original impetus for that, where that opening sentence came from 9 years ago and the process since then and the themes as well, I guess, that you're...
I was wondering here because there are kind of positive inspirations for my novel and kind of negative inspirations. So the novel I call it kind of a theological novel. So it is the characters and the themes of the book are about not so much the existence or non-existence of God in a sense, because we can't know that. Even Richard Dawkins knows we can't be for certain about that. But I'm interested in, so the book is about what I call if God exists, the nature of God. Because for me, we had new atheism was a very loud group of people in the early noughties. Claiming the second death of God, as it were. And then we had fundamentalism, whether it was Christian fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism. It seemed both of them, and I'm not the only one, I mean, Terry Eagleton's very good at this, seemed to be talking about something that no normal person was really engaging with. And therefore I wanted to take the debate out of the polarities of the new atheist on one side and the evangelicals, if you want, on the other side, and try and reclaim a space for how we might talk about something that is not super reductionist, materialist, or whatever. So that was kind of, that came from, I mean, a number of things happened. I mean, I've talked about this in pieces I've written about the novel, but I was deeply moved by Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, which is a novel about a Congregationalist minister in the Midwest in the 1950s. An acquaintance of mine, or a friend of mine, died very young, and her death had a profound impact on me. And Rowan Williams becoming Archbishop of Canterbury, the manner in which he talked about theology, he's a very cautious, careful speaker, someone who's very philosophically grounded, a great, admirer of Wittgenstein and whatever. I suddenly realized that I wasn't an atheist, but that didn't mean that not being an atheist doesn't necessarily mean you're anything else.
Was that something you'd sort of identified to yourself as an atheist previously?
I don't think I was particularly passionately atheist, but I think in my 20s and my 30s, I think I was predisposed to atheism rather than predisposed to theism. And then I realised that I probably was more predisposed to theism. But everyone talks about atheism and everyone talks about being Christian or religion. No one actually talks about being theist. Which is a perfectly legitimate position. And you know, to be predisposed to theism is and even now it's very interesting. Is that, you know, I can tell people I'm not an atheist, and they want to know what religion I'm part of, and that's
delves into it.
Yeah, and so in a sense, I just wanted to write about.
Was it a sense of exploration of where you were on these issues as you wrote it, or was it more to look at the sort of cultural impacts and trends like new atheism or fundamentalism and the wider picture? Were you trying to get that sort of more epic overview, or was it more a process of trying to discover what you yourself felt and sort of?
Yeah, I think it's more. It's more of a personal exploration. It's very much about a single man and his family and a bunch of friends. So, it touches on. It's not a State of the Nation book, although of course, I kind of feel those kind of novels never really work. You're literally trying to have, you know, you have a reprint, you know. I think, was it Jonathan, no, what's his name, John Lanchester's Capital, that, you know, sort of had a, you know, had someone from the city and had a footballer in it, you know. I mean, it tried to make sure it had all the touch points of contemporary culture. Mine doesn't do that, because I think it's a book that it actually is quite narrow but wants to go deep. Its scope is one of trying to explore through almost the uselessness of language when dealing. I mean, it's one of the themes in it is that, you know, language doesn't really work when you try to talk about God outside. The moment you talk about God, you essentially create a religion. That's what language does, and so the irony in the book, of course, is it's 200,000 words about not being able to speak about the subject it speaks about.
Well, I think there's an interesting aspect of language in that when you look at any religion, nearly any religion is based around
a book,
sacred text.
Yeah.
You don't have religions that are based around a song you have music and artwork,
yeah,
that's peripheral to a religion, but the central core part is always,
yeah,
text, which is,
yeah,
always words, which does something to transmit,
yeah,
whatever theological outlook it is, even if it may not be able to grasp it.
But I think, you're absolutely right. So it does transmit the sacred texts do transmit. I mean, they're a relationship, so one gives as much as one takes. There's an expectation that it's going to transmit something, and that's an interesting dynamic. The problem, of course, is the moment they become sacred texts and written down, they become different from each other, and then we're in trouble. And one of Dawkins' more idiotic pronouncements is somehow God doesn't exist because all the religious texts are different. Well, it's a logical fallacy. They are different, but that doesn't mean God doesn't exist. It means that they are different. But the point is are they to a certain degree speaking something that is the same? Is there kinship in the expressions? And of course, there will be kinships because they've all been written by human beings with some sense of a kind of transcendental feeling in them, or feeling of the numinous or whatever. And we have you know, expressed it differently, you know, across culture, across cultures. But there's an interesting, I mean, my argument for this is interesting. I remember hearing Noam Chomsky speak 25, 30 years ago, and he came up with this idea, I think, in the 60s about language being deep structure of language, is that language is innate in us on some very deep level that cannot be proved or disproved. But and he was saying that anyone, you know, any alien listening in to the globe speaking would think we were all talking the same language. So, you know, if somebody, they were listening to English and Chinese and Hindi and whatever, actually on a deep structure level, they're all the same. They just superficially sound different. And that's what I think about the expressions of religion. Is in fact, if, you know, if an alien came and saw our sacred texts, they'd be going, they're saying all the same thing. It's just the built up is the different narratives, but on some deep structural level, they're just saying the same thing.
And do you see any difference with the writing of fiction? How do you see fiction fitting in within the sort of broader scope of literature in general, and all texts? How does your novel, for instance, deals with a lot of the themes that are in theological texts,
yeah,
but it's classed as fiction, whereas
yeah,
you know, classed as theological text. What is the relationship there? What should fiction be trying to do if that's a sensible question?
No, I think it's the most important question, because what fiction does is it personalizes and humanizes in a way that I imagine if I always kind of think to myself that if Richard Dawkins is on one side of the stage and what's his name, the mathematician Christian, John, God, I remember his name now. Okay, so let's say Rowan Williams for now. But they're on the extreme sides of the stage, whereas myself and, let's say, Philip Pullman, who's a sort of atheist novelist, we would sit much closer together, but we still sit separately. And I think that's a much more useful place. And so I think the novelist in fiction actually talks about the lived experience of these forms of life, you know, atheists or theists or whatever. And that's much more useful for the average person, is to kind of go, you can't, the average person doesn't want to read works of theology, and actually it's very unhelpful to read kind of evangelical new atheism, because they're on a crusade as well, so they're skewing the narrative. Also, everyone's skewing the narrative, whereas fiction is about showing the human lived experience of often not knowing, but tilting one way or the other. And that seems to me a very valuable, and is what fiction should do.
Do you see that also playing into a sense of creating the human lived experience? Does fiction, is it something that should just reflect experiences, or should it be something that can sort of help people construct?
Yeah, I think it should. I think it should help
frame them for the future.
Yeah, I think it should help people. I would say that a successful novel that is in fact dealing with ideas to a certain degree, and most novels that deal with ideas often aren't successful, should at least open up ways of thinking. And so I think Marilyn Robinson's Gilead had an effect on me. I think it opened up a possibility to an experience or of God outside of actually of the kind of the kind of religious confession she was talking about. And so, you know, if my novel is successful, and my novel is should be deeply ambiguous and equivocal about lots of things, but if one is struggling with a sense of the possibility of the existence of God, but doesn't feel themselves inclined towards religion, then my novel should suggest a way of thinking about these things that is isn't pushing them, you know, towards any kind of organized religion. But the idea that one can, I mean, the point is as my novel, the language, after a while the language dries up before you end up kind of going, does that sound a little bit like Christianity? Does that sound a little bit like Buddhism? Does that, you know, because religions have covered most of the, you know, different religions have covered most of the stuff that we're concerned with.
Yeah. And the converse of that is, do you have any concept of what makes bad fiction? Is it just simply dull and you close the book, or are there elements?
Well, I do think interestingly, I would have said before writing this, during writing this, and even writing that most novels that where ideas quite clearly most often fail. But I think what I've tried to do is make it mine so character driven and that the reader can forgive the idea that there are genuine conversations that you might have had in a 19th century novel, you know, where people actually talk about theological ideas. So, but I often think ideas-driven novels are a failure. But I mean, for me, bad fiction is, I mean, I'm a great believer in that if you're not a, I mean, lots of people want to be writers. Lots of people, you know, I don't want to be a writer, I hate it.
You've done that.
Yeah. No, but I've always hated it. I've always found it really, really difficult and really unpleasant. And someone once said to me, I'm going away on a writing retreat. What do you think I should do? I said, take a bucket, because if you don't vomit, you're not doing it right. Because that's how hard I find it. It makes me want to vomit. It's whatever.
There's a great Ernest Hemingway quote for writing's easy, you just sit in front of the typewriter and bleed.
yeah. And so there are a lot of people who love the idea of being a writer. It's a very romantic notion. They think they've got lots of things to say. I think that's one of the problems is that bad fiction comes from people who aren't really meant to be writers. They just think they are and want to be. And if you don't actually have, I mean, terrible things, if you don't have a modest enough gift at making sentences and characters into a story, then it just isn't going to be very good. But I would often say that you can divide fiction into, you know, the sort of priorities, and there's, you know, sentence making, character, and story. And I think all good writers kind of know what they love best and are really good at that, but you can't not be good at all of them, really. And so if you can't do story, in the end people aren't going to read you. And story is a very vague thing, it's not plot or narrative, but in the end you are telling, you know, there is some kind of deep responsibility to exchange. If it's not really about the lived experience, other human beings won't be interested, because that's, I think, part of the psychological exchange, the emotional exchange. I would probably say, for me, the most important thing is sentence making. But if I'm honest, if you can do good character and good story, average sentence making probably means you can write a half-decent novel. I'm unlikely to get past page 10, because for me, sentence making is, you know, if I don't feel that you know, that they're the writer is trying to make good sentences, you know, and know that organically they've got to, you know, you've got to make good paragraphs and good pages and whatever. But that's...
And are those three aspects something you're conscious of as you're writing, or is that something you sort of think about in retrospect? Like, as you're coming back to what you wrote on day one and sort of reading back through it, are you consciously editing the sentences according to any sort of...
No, I think I'm consciously editing the sentences because I'm semi-consciously editing the sentences because I'm just editing them when essentially I'm reading it and I go, that doesn't feel right. Mm. And I think that's just what kind of novelist I am. I kind of feel that I'm pretty sure that character is something I can do, so I don't really worry about that so much. That's the bit I think that, yeah, when it comes to it. Story, on the other hand, I think is something which most writers find difficult because it's really hard to judge whether it's there or not, and what it is, and so that's the tough one. That's the tough one when you kind of go, you sort of basically at some point 30,000 words in, you kind of have to make decisions about
what. Do you make those decisions as you're writing, or do you close the laptop for the day and then a couple of hours later think over the storyline that you're going to add on the next day? Is it all done outside of the writing process?
If it's going well, I think the writing takes you there. I think you just type, you know, essentially someone will just go, I'm now leaving for Paris. And you go, what? Hold on a second. I mean, at its best, I think that's what happens. The characters will dictate where the story's going. If they're doing that, the chances are that you have a story. And it's interesting because when I was teaching creative writing, I used to say, you know, that the story, narrative and plot don't mix up the three. You know, story is essentially the emotional heart. Narrative is how you tell it. You know, what kind of narrative you're going to use. And plot is kind of what happens. But if you don't have the emotional heart, then actually all the rest, you're just trying to catch up. But actually, I don't think as a writer, you can kind of know whether you captured an emotional heart. I mean, I don't...
As you say, you get to the final full stop and it's
that
things kind of click into place often.
So with my Brian Asterius noise, I remember actually, a very good friend of mine came over from the US and we were talking about John le Carré's A Perfect Spy. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's his big novel. You know, it's his big, you know, whatever. And it's brilliant. I mean, it really is compared to any other of his books. It's absolutely a work of great literature. And we were talking about it, and Valerie said, he just knew what his story was. All the way through it, you know, so he could work the language, he could do whatever he wants because he knew what the story was. And I suddenly realised at that point, that's the problem with my Buenos Aires. I didn't know what the story was. But I didn't know that while writing it. And so I think that's really hard. And I in my day job, I have to, you know, advise people in the creative industries, you know, in advertising and in broadcasting, you know, what a story might be. And it's really hard. You just can't work it out.
It's quite a nebulous.
Yeah.
It kind of encompasses everything, yeah. But then...
Yeah, I mean, if you, in a sense, you take Camus' The Outsider, he starts with, you know, the first line is, today my mother died. In a sense, that story, you know, from that point on, I mean, when you think of the beginning of, you know, if you think of the beginning of, you know, Hamlet or King Lear, you almost have to basically start with an emotional position. And then if you're any good, you can roll it out from that point. But if you try and manufacture story by going, you know, there were two brothers and they were very different, and then that one went to university and then and one stayed, you're like kind of going, that's somehow that's not story, that's just a construct, and then or a conceit, and but why isn't that story? Why isn't that story? I don't know, but it kind of isn't.
Yeah, but as I say, I mean, I can't remember the start of Brothers Karamazov, for instance. Like, but there's a lot of element reading that there. It feels quite sort of two brothers and another brother.
So yeah.
It's very like, but it's a very emotionally.
Yeah, but yes, form. But that's yes, that's true. But I mean, there are different. We bring to the reading of 19th century novels a different kind of, i.e. we allow those 19th century novels to actually build these things with very intense language and character. But actually, it really is, remember, it is a whodunit. And if we're allowed ridiculous digressions, I mean, what's interesting about Dostoevsky, in a sense, is that he is a dramatist first. He basically, you know, from we take the Idiot, from you know, from 10 pages in, he's driving all of his characters into one room, and for about 60 pages, they'll all behave insanely. And actually, that's what we're... It's in a sense, it's not story. It's drama. And so, I mean, whereas the beginning of Crime and Punishment actually kind of is story, because we've suddenly... You know, with page one, we've got this fevered, poor student who's looking to kill someone. And sort of in a sense that story, but Dostoevsky doesn't. I mean, most of his novels are structural failures, because actually he doesn't really do story. He does it really intense, dramatic, you know, 90-page scenes where everyone behaves appallingly, and then you know, and then long passages of disquisition on whatever. But I think Brothers Karamazov succeeds because of how awful the dad is, and we then care about the characters. So I think the story comes about it. But I think you're right. I mean, we can't answer this, but we know it when we see it.
I think there's three aspects of plot, narrative, and story are sort of constantly moving.
Yeah.
You can sort of pin one down for a short while, but then the other two move around somewhere else. And, what works?
And then, you know, the person who says, by the way, I'm moving to Paris yesterday, that might be a critical moment in the story, but it's a plot point. You know, so yeah, you can't pull them apart. But I think it's important, especially with writers who, you know, inexperienced writers, is to make sure, I think the cardinal sin, as it were, is to think that plot is story. And to plot something out and think, all because stuff happens, I've got a story. And that's the problem. I think what you have to kind of go is, you know, what is that slightly intangible emotional driver that gives the thing some kind of emotional propulsion, which means you can write and allow the thing to take shape, and then those plot points will hopefully grow out of the story. I mean, you know, my novel, there is an organic story, because someone leaves their family to do something extreme. That is story. But actually, that's all you have to say. Someone leaves their family to do something extreme. You just know there is emotional fallout.
So in a sense,
no one needs to sit there kind of going, you know, there's a brother and a sister and there's a... That doesn't create story. Story is in a sense, an incident that you know can't help but create, you know, an emotional narrative or in fact, drama. But it's very hard to isolate. Some people are great storytellers without being very good writers. Some people, you know, write very good plots, you know, and they know if they can get you, you know, three pages in, they'll do something that will make you go, I need to find out. And they are all different gifts. But I think literature that endures does. I have no idea whether Dostoevsky is a particularly good writer because I can't read Russian.
My sense of reading Dostoevsky was never by the words are flying off the page. This is.
I think there's some very bad translations though. Yeah. Is it Constance Garnett?
Who
did so? I think the copy of The Idiot that I read was. The one that she translated, it was just free on an e-reader. And then reading a bit more about it, people saying avoid her translations like the plague, they're really unfaithful.
It's interesting, so I've read quite a lot of translations of Dostoevsky. She's the flattest, but the kind of most honest. So to be honest, translations need to capture more than the kind of literal version.
So there's always a payoff between this sort of meaning and the literal structure.
And David Margashark, who did the translations in the 70s, he gives the most kind of atmosphere, but is slightly kind of over-Russifying it, as it were. And then slightly later, we've kind of had a middle way where it feels as though it's more honest to the text, but keeps the atmosphere. But you're right. But he's not. You know, what Dostoevsky is doing with prose is trying to get us to feel things intensely. And so it's very heightened, but it's crafted to create a feeling in us of emotional intensity. It's not poetic ever. It's never doing something. My favourite prose stylist of all time is James Salter, and he's just making sure that there is a kind of that something happens in the sentence that delivers a kind of an intangible something, sentence by sentence, and that's...
Yeah, there's some writers there, you almost have a texture or a taste of each sentence, and other writers, the prose is very... There's no texture, but you read several pages and you've got a sort of emotional impact of, oof, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think James Salter say that the second first paragraph of the second chapter of Light Years, he says, makes you feel like reading it made her feel like reading a letter, and it's a sentence that made her stop. I can't remember what it is, but the point is that's what James Salter does, is he doesn't mind you stopping at a sentence. Even if it's a sort of implicit, you know, half a second, it stopped you because it's done something. Whereas, you know, Dostoevsky wants to build up emotional and momentum. So he doesn't want you ever to stop.
Yeah.
whatever. I would like to achieve both things. You know, at times you basically want to be able to slow the reader down so the prose can do things, and then you want momentum, especially with 200,000 words, because you need them to, you know, persist in reading.
So that was Neil Griffiths. Thank you for listening to the very first episode of Unsigned Methods. We hope you enjoyed it.
If you have enjoyed it, please spread the word far and wide. Let anyone you know who's interested in writers, writing, anything artistic or creative. We can be found in all the usual podcasting places. You can follow us at Unsound Methods on Twitter or find our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
Join us in 2 weeks when we're speaking to Megan Dunn about her excellent novel Tinderbox and all things writing related.